trade. Jacksonville is. I literally threw my cards, and she was like, "What's going on?" And I was like, "I need to hear this. I need." I'm listening to Todd McShay on The Ringer in my ears. I'm watching the draft live on ESPN, and I was like, "I'm screaming! What is happening? What is happening?"
This motherfucker don't shower. Well, I do. I'm just not very good at it.
Everybody, welcome to episode number 16 of the Trey and Treeb Show. Normally, I don't sit here and give intros, but when we got somebody on that, you know, I find on the internet that has the same amount of followers as I do, I think it's right that we do an intro. So without further ado, please welcome our guest, Brendan Tassif. Brendan, how are you doing, bro?
Good. How are you guys doing?
Not too shabby. I was telling Brendan before this thing started, this is a comedy podcast that Trey and I are trying to grow. They say you need to bring on people that have the same following as you. And I found this man right here. And, you know, I thought he was going to be a lot like me and Trey, where, you know, his content is not the best. It's mostly racism and homophobic jokes like me and Trey dish out every single week. He has a podcast called My Ex-Drinking Buddy, where he...
Your Ex-Drinking Buddy.
Oh, Your Ex-Drinking Buddy. He's a stand-up comedian. Where are you based out of, Brennan?
New York City. It's the only place to do stand-up.
Yeah, that's what I hear, but I hear Austin, Texas is where all the comedy assassins are going, Brennan. Why aren't you in Austin, Texas?
Because I'm a real stand-up comic. Ow! If you look at me on paper, people could very much be like, oh, that's a bro. I would say I'm more bro adjacent, which is actually the tour that I feature on for the great Matt Folscher on. We're touring around the country. It's called the Bro Adjacent Tour because of that whole thing where it's like the friends that, you know, we make in this industry and like the people that like we hang out with. A lot of times, just like I said, if you were like, oh, he's a Division I athlete, he used to party real hard, he's been arrested 8 times, people would be like, oh, you're like a bro. But it's like, yeah, but I also cry at Extra Gum commercials because I'm incredibly empathetic and like sweet. I'm a sweet, sweet boy. And it's like, I'm very much not that guy. So I'm in New York because I don't know. New York was always the place I was told to go. I started in Florida in 2009, got back into it in Jacksonville in 2018. And the goal was get good enough and then go to New York. And that's what I did.
So, yeah, you mentioned Florida. Is that where you're originally from?
Yeah, born and raised. I lived in Florida until I was 30. With one stint, I went to Oklahoma City for like 3 months when my alcoholism got really bad to live with my cousin. And we were doing stand up out there. And I lived with him for about 3 months. The day I'd never seen snow until I moved to New York. The day I saw like ice, I woke up one morning and there was ice everywhere. I was like, fuck this, I'm out. And I left to go back to Florida.
I have to ask, we both don't happen to be Duval till we die, right? Or who's your football squad?
Tony Khan was a regular at my restaurant. I'm Duval till I die, baby.
Are you really, dude? Hell yeah, dude. I'd never meet Jags fans anywhere.
Huge Jags fan. At my old apartment before I moved in with my girlfriend, I had the big banner in the background when I recorded and everything.
I actually got my YouTube chops talking about the Jags. I have
Do you know about Treeb Talks?
No.
Yeah, that used to be the YouTube channel before I rebranded everything to the Trey and Treeb Show, put all my eggs in the retard basket. but I talked about the Jags for, you know, a solid year straight. Got 1400 subscribers. How did you become a Jags fan? So I played NFL Street 3 on my PSP, and Fred Taylor was an absolute monster.
Fragile Freddie Taylor.
And I fell in love with Freddie T. And for some reason, who else I fell in love with? Byron Leftwich. So big Byron Leftwich guy.
Yeah.
And you know, he doesn't get his due diligence.
At all. He was a very good quarterback, but this is, you know, in the beginning of the times where, because it was interesting, because, you know, there was Warren Moon who had, you know, had the Super Bowl run and everything. But a lot of times, especially when it was a black quarterback, people were like, oh, they got to be an athlete, like a Michael Vick sort of situation. And Byron was like, no, I ripped the ball. But I think it just got lost in the shuffle, where there was still this weird thing where there was obviously this embedded racism that black guys couldn't be quarterback, and especially not like a pocket passer. So I think he kind of just got lost to history, because his stats weren't outstanding, but he could still, you know, him and Jimmy Smith were out there just ripping it.
No, that's a good point. And you know, what's funny is that you talk about Byron Leftwich not being athletic, and they just decided to bring in another fat black guy who is slightly more athletic than him, and David Garrard.
David Garrard's my guy. I've waited on him a bunch. He's a sweetheart. I love David Garrard. His wife is super cool too.
Yeah, no, my first real Jags moment that sold me and said, this is going to be my team for life, is the Hail Mary Mike Thomas moment.
Yeah, that was awesome.
That was the moment. And I don't want to get too in the weeds with the Jags, but how about Travis Hunter, bro? That's awesome.
So I have on my Instagram, it's a pinned story, years ago when they made that trade, the Giants made the trade for Daniel Jones. And I remember doing a story on my Instagram being like, now we can take Josh Allen. And I'm like screaming into the camera. I'm like, here we go. And that's who we picked. And I've met Josh too. He's a sweetheart of a man. But that paled in comparison to what happened this year. I was so Thursday night is my date night with my girlfriend, but she's a school teacher, so she normally goes to bed pretty early. And I'm like, hey, normally we watch like a show or a movie, because we work opposite schedules, obviously, with me doing comedy and her being a teacher. But I was like, we got to watch the draft on Thursday. And I was like, oh, maybe I'll like film myself again, you know, doing the reaction to the pick. And we're playing a card game, Monopoly Deal, fun card game. Her and I are playing. And dude, when it was like, da-da-da-da-da, there's been a trade, Jacksonville, I literally threw my cards, and she was like, what's going on? And I was like, I need to hear this. I'm listening to Todd McShay on The Ringer in my ears. I'm watching the draft live on ESPN. And I was like, I'm screaming, what is happening? What is happening?
Dude, that's funny. I have a pretty similar story, except I was more of a piece of shit and mind my fiance. So she was taking a nap, because we also worked separate schedules, and she was on the couch, and I was like, oh, I'm going to watch the draft. And then Ian Rappaport pops up on the screen. Jags are trading for the number 2 pick. No fucking way. Yeah. And I wake her up from her nap, dude. And she's so pissed. She goes into her room, but I don't care. This is a franchise changing move, dude.
Well, and it was interesting too, because I'm a big believer in building in the trenches as a former offensive lineman in high school. And then a fullback in college. I was always like, you have to everyone's like, oh, maybe Ashton Jeanty. And I go, Saquon Barkley is worth maybe one win for the Giants, but then you put him behind a great offensive line like the Eagles, and he's worth a lot more. So everyone's talking about maybe Ashton Jeanty will go to the Jags. And I go, we don't need a running back. Like, we need a guard. We need a tackle. We need a interior defensive lineman to put more pressure on the quarterback so Trayvon and Josh can do their thing. And I was like, we got to take Mason Graham. We got to take Mason Graham. Stay at 5, take Mason Graham. Then Gladstone throws his nuts on the table. And he's like, nah, we're going to trade up and take Travis Hunter. And in the moment, I was super like freaked out and excited. But I have been on my sports show, I've been talking shit about Travis Hunter, not as a person or as an athlete, but I'm like, he's 188 pounds and he wants to play both ways. Like, I don't think this is going to work. And I was like, we should have taken Mason Graham. And now, what is it, 3 weeks removed? I'm totally off the Mason Graham boat. He's completely out of shape. Everyone's saying it was the other defensive tackle at Michigan that they had to double and triple team, which is why Mason Graham had the stats that he had. And Travis Hunter is like taking selfies with people on airplanes. And I'm like, I'm all in. Give me a number 12 jersey. I'm all in.
So I just had to jump in here because I am unfortunately a Patriots fan. And I just have to ask you, are you still butthurt about Miles Jack not being down?
Well, Miles Jack wasn't down, so there's nothing to be upset about.
We would have dominated in that Super Bowl. I mean, we would have killed Nick Foles. Our defense would have carried us to the Super Bowl, and I would have been the happiest boy in my entire life.
Can I, real quick, I know you wanted to say one thing, but I was working at the Mortons in Jacksonville at the Hyatt, which is a regular spot, because that Hyatt is right next to the stadium, so it's where all the away teams stay. And after that Saxonville run, I think it was after the Steelers game, because I think that was a home game. Calais Campbell, Josh Allen as a rookie, all those guys were at the Morton's bar drinking Louis the 13th until like 2 a.m, just screaming Saxonville. And like Calais, his nickname's the mayor in Jacksonville because like he's the man. And dude, to see a 6'8" guy just hammering shots of like $500 a glass cognac, you're like, we're doing it, man. We're going to win the Super Bowl. And then we got cheated by the Patriots.
Why did you want to get, you know, change from sport to comedy? Because it is a weird transition, and I'm kind of going through that right now.
Yeah, 100%. It is an odd transition. Football was taken from me. I got my 8th concussion and then could no longer play. This is back 2008 when I was playing at FAU. Practice one day, Franz Joseph came through the middle, and I, as the fullback on scout team, went to block him up, and he fucking murdered me. And he ended up getting drafted by the Raiders. So that checked out. It made sense. And this is at a time when the NFL is being sued by its former players. Concussions were in the zeitgeist, especially in 2008, 2009. You know, they're doing that movie Concussion with Will Smith. And so I get called into the trainer's office. This is, you know, your 8th documented concussion between high school and college. You know, we can medically white shirt you. You can stay on your partial scholarship, but you're no longer going to be playing for the Owls. And then things got really dark because I was always like a big party guy. I got into drinking really late in high school, but when I discovered it, I like loved it because it made my anxiety and depression go away. And so I just kind of dove headfirst into drinking. And I also, this is a story I tell on my podcast ad nauseum, but when I was 12, that same cousin I went to live with in Oklahoma City introduced me to stand up Comedy Central Presents. And I would record them on VHS and just watch them over and over. Because as an anxious kid, it was like a relief to watch something that could elicit laughter just by words. So I had been in love with comedy up for 10 years up to that point. Like I can still do verbatim, like, you know, a lot of like Tom Rhodes and Mitch Hedberg and all those, like Greg Giraldo, all those original specials, because I watched them so much. So football had ended. I was in love. I had been in love with comedy for a long time. And I was drinking like crazy. So I was like, the natural progression was, hey, maybe I should try this. And that's just kind of what happened. I was actually just talking to someone on my podcast about this. The first mic I did, I was still trying to live in that persona of like the football jock guy. And so I was doing horrific material, like bad, like I was trying to be like a bro version of Jeselnik, which is not who I am. That's what I was trying to do. But I remember I had one bit that got a laugh. I was talking about watching, I watch a lot of porn with like black guys and white women, because it reminds me of when I played college football and all my teammates and stuff. And I said that bit and it got like a chuckle. And I was like, oh, I'm in. Like, I'm never going to stop doing stand up. Like, just for people to laugh at something that I had thought about, because that is true. That is something I had thought about. And to say it into a microphone and have people be like, oh, that's actually kind of funny. I was like, oh, this is awesome.
I've never done a mic. And that's something that me and Trey want to do. You know, we live here in Lewiston, Idaho. And the closest mic that we have to us is Spokane, Washington, the Spokane Comedy Club. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the next natural progression. But there is something, that feeling
How
that you get.
It?
It's two hours.
2 hours, yeah.
How many people do you have where you're at?
Like 40,000.
40,000.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Because this is the thing that I tell everybody. It doesn't matter. Like, I mean, obviously, if you were in a city with like 1,000 people, it'd be different. But 40,000 is not tiny. I mean, it's small, but it's not like insignificant. The thing I always tell everybody is you just make your own mic. Just find a bar and ask them what their slowest night is. And then when they go, oh, it's Tuesday, be like, can we do a mic here on Tuesday? Like, we'll bring like at least 4 or 5 people will come and buy drinks, which is probably more than they already have. That's, I mean, in any city, that's how you build the scene, is just doing shit like that.
So just you would suggest like going to a bar and trying to start your own mic that way, or at least trying to find a day of the week at a bar where you can try and do a set.
Yeah, the trick is to always make it more incentivizing than like, hey, we want to do stand up. Just go, hey, you know, what's your slowest night of the week? And if you guys are open, like you stay open, even though it's the slowest night of the week, we were thinking about starting an open mic. So it'll be at least us two. We'll bring some people. And, you know, we'll buy, you know, we don't drink, but we'll buy food and stuff. And at least, because to them, it doesn't make a difference. Like, they're going to be open anyway. So you might as well have five guaranteed people than just the two random people that walk in and leave after one beer. You know what I mean?
So when did you do your first mic, and how did you go out the next night, or did you kind of wait a little bit, or how'd you get consistent?
So I did my first mic in 2009. Cisco Duren, huge shout out, who's still real big in the South Florida comedy scene, was hosting the mic. He's the one who put it all together. And I just Googled, this is 2009, so I Googled like stand-up open mics in South Florida, found it, got hammered out of my mind and went. And immediately I was like, oh, this is awesome. This is something I want to do. But I was still in college. I think I still had my license at the time. I went through a decade without a license because all the DUIs and stuff. But I still had my license at the time. But it was one of those things where I did it and I was like, oh, like I'm doing comedy now. I went 2 weeks later, I went to the same open mic and did worse. Yeah, I did a lot worse. I don't remember that one. I was blacked out, but apparently I did a lot worse. But then I immediately changed. Like any new handle I got, anything I ever did was Brennan T Comedy. I got the Gmail for Brennan T Comedy and I was like, oh, I'm going to do comedy. So fast forward 6 years, 7 years. I'm doing it sporadically, like on and off. I'm still telling people if they're like, oh, what do you do? It's like, oh, I wait tables, but I'm also like doing comedy. I didn't fully get back into it until I got sober in 2018. So I had done shitty mics all over the country, like in South Georgia, Florida. When I moved to Oklahoma City, we were doing shows like every single night. But I was doing it so poorly because I was hammered all the time. And then when I got sober, about 2 months into being sober, I remember telling my sponsor, hey, if my life is now working two jobs, going to the gym and a meeting every day, you can have it back. Like, I don't want this. I don't want this. And he said, you got to find something you're passionate about. And he was the one who was actually like, what about stand-up? Like, you were obsessed with that. Why don't you try that again? And then that's when I really, so now, like, especially in New York, when people ask me, when did I start? I always say 2018, because it's weird to say 2009 and not have a career as big as I should. But I always say 2018, because that's when I was doing the work that's required, which is getting on stage every day when you first start, doing at least a mic a day, sometimes doing two or three mics in a day. That's when I really jumped back into all that.
And, you know, I see you working hard all the time. I follow you on Instagram and you post a lot of clips of you doing stand up. And, you know, I listen to guys like Joe List, who's one of my favorites, and you interviewed
friend of my
him,
show. Joe's been on my show.
Yeah. And that's the first one of your podcasts I watched from beginning to end. I love Joe List. I'm a Tuesday for life. And, you know, he talked to Mark on Tuesdays with Stories about how, you know, he doesn't know the balance between, you know, saving material and posting.
I talk
clips
to him about this all the time.
You know, how do you find that balance as a comedian where you want to save the juicy bits and also you want to run like a social media platform to get your name out there and still share some of your best material from your comedy set?
So this is what I was told by a couple friends of mine who have a massive following on social media. The internet doesn't give a shit. And this is something I actually have talked to List and a few other guys like bigger comics about. You can post a bit and then do it on a show and then post it again 6 months later. Like, nobody remembers. Nobody cares. We often forget that the circles are much bigger than we realize. So like if I have a clip and it gets 10,000 views, it's like, wow, that's a lot for me. But at the same time, it's like those are 10,000 people, probably a few of which maybe live in New York. New York's got 12 million people. So like the chances that someone's going to see that again at a show isn't very high. And also nobody, like I used to watch comedy on my girlfriend and her brother come to a lot of my shows because she's very supportive. And he's actually a big fan of my stand up because he grew up in a world that was very opposite of mine. Like, you know, mine was chaos. His was more structured. So he loves my comedy because I've grown my voice that I've found as a storyteller. And so he likes hearing those stories. And he said something to me that was very interesting. He goes, you know, I've heard you do the same bit a few times, but it's never the same bit. It's always different because as a storyteller, it's not just set up punch. You know, people react in the audience differently to it. And then you react to how they react. So it's always different.
So how did you figure out you were a storyteller and how did you go from that? Because I imagine when you started, you went setup punch, but how did you kind of figure that storytelling was your bread and butter?
So for any comedian, and you know, I'm not the most famous comedian in the world, but I do, this is my life. This is what I've dedicated it to. So I have had this conversation with people who are famous and who don't, like, I've had people on my podcast before and I've been like, how'd you get into stand up? And literally people have answered like, oh, I wanted to be famous. And this was the easiest way to do it because the barrier to entry for comedy is so easy. Like I said, you guys could go to a bar, start a mic, and now you are professional. You're getting paid to do comedy. Like, it's that easy. At least, like with acting, you have to do auditions. With music, you have to learn a fucking instrument. With comedy, you just get a PA and a mic and you just go out and go, I'm a comedian, watch me now. So finding a voice is, for me, was difficult because, like I said, when I very first got on stage, I thought I was going to be like the bro comic. Because that's not who I am, but that was the perception of me because I'm, you know, I'm 6'1", former athlete, like white guy. I was like, oh, I gotta be like this guy. So it was through trial and error. It was like trying to write setup punch and being like, I hate this. This feels like homework. I don't like this. And then being with friends and telling stories and keeping people's interest and engagement and people being like, then what happened? And being like, oh, I like this way more. I like world building. I like character building. And then through all the shenanigans that I put myself through with my alcoholism and drug addiction, I realized that I had these stories that now that I have lived through them seem funny. At the time, they were super depressing. But now when I talk about spending $30,000 in 28 days in Daytona Beach, now it's funny. At the time, it's what led me to go to rehab. But now it's hilarious because it's like, how can you burn through that much money in a shitty place like Daytona? And it's like, yeah, you find a way. So it was through a lot of trial and error. It was getting on stage all the time and being, and God's honest truth, it's about what, as a comic, it's about what you want to do. There's 8 billion people in the world. You'll find an audience. And like in my case, I moved to the greatest city in the world for stand-up and I am respected amongst my peers. I've got plenty of numbers, not to like be this guy, but I've got plenty of numbers of comics you've heard of and everyone listening to this has heard of that I could text right now and be like, yo, what are you doing? Let's hang out. But I still haven't. And I say all that to say, like, I am respected by my peers as well, but I haven't broken through that barrier. But that's not to say because there's not an audience for me. It's just they haven't found me yet. So you and the royal you have to just figure out what you want to do, what you want to talk about and make it funny. Because a friend of mine who's real big in Jacksonville, Chris Buck, told me once, I go, maybe I was working on a bit and I go, maybe it's just not funny. And he goes, well, wait, do you think it's funny? And I go, yeah. He goes, then it's funny. You're a person with a sense of humor and you think it's funny. He goes, you just need to figure out how to make that funny to the people in the audience, make it relatable, make it. And that's what I found with storytelling is you can really build a world to where people understand what you're talking about. And I'm just bad at setup punch.
Yeah, no. And that's why I have a lot of respect for you, because I know that just through watching your stuff and watching your podcast, you obviously are respected in the stand up world, and to do a small show like this and giving us your time, we really do respect.
Oh, no, that. Absolutely. Yeah, no, I mean, I was, it's a weird thing too, because you guys, it's different obviously with just the location, but being in New York, it's totally different than when I was in Florida, but it's the same thing. It's like, it's not a I know quite a few people that are, would be considered famous comedians, but I've watched them bomb because it's just, it's comedy is totally subjective. So it's one of those things where it's like, I was where you guys were 2 years ago. Now I've got like episodes banked for the next like 3 or 4 weeks and I can just make a call and be like, hey, guest bailed this week. Do you want to come on the show? And people are like, hell yeah. I thought you'd never ask and stuff, which is awesome. But dude, 2 years ago, I was begging people to come on my show because nobody. And then you get people like Josh Adam Myers, Emma Willman, Joe List, Natalie Cuomo. Now all of a sudden it's like, oh shit, Brennan's got like a real show and it becomes easier. But that's the thing is like, if you sent me a DM and you're like, yeah, let's just shoot the shit about you for an hour. I was like, fuck yeah, I'll be there.
Yeah.
That's how you get any comedian on a show.
I can talk about me?
Yeah. I found the way to get any comedian on a show. That's a good.
Exactly. I say that all the time, especially because I didn't know. So when I first moved to New York, I was asking comics I had no business asking to come on my show. And some of them would say yes. And I just didn't realize. And now I'm a little more gun shy when it comes to that, but I still will. If it's a bigger comic that I really like and respect, I'll be like, hey, I know you got such and such coming out. You want to promote it on my show? And I name drop the biggest people who have ever done my show. And they're like, I would say probably 70% of the time, they're like, yeah, sure, let's do that. Because mm-hmm. It's like, you want to come on, talk about what you're doing, promote your thing? I'll listen.
We're writers. I'm a journalist by trade. Trey, he does like scary stories, and he's like writing the comedy. So like, we're writers. So yeah. To hear some like words of wisdom and to hear things like that, it's a positive experience. But it also kind of makes you think like, God, maybe I just need to get out of fucking Idaho. You know what I mean?
So that's... Yeah, I completely understand that. But the thing I will tell you is, it's the same thing with being an alcoholic, is you think you're the only one and you think you're unique, but you're not. There's plenty of people in Idaho that listen to JRE, that listen to Your Mom's House, that listen to Tuesdays with Stories. The trick is just finding out where they are or who they are. And that's a big thing, is because it's like, I learned this a long time ago. When I moved back to Daytona after college, I was like, there's no scene here. And then eventually end up in Jacksonville, get a part of the scene there. And, you know, the rest is what we already talked about. Come to find out, there's a huge scene in Daytona. I just didn't look for it. I just wasn't. One of my best friends now, Zach Bennett, who lives in LA, like created the Daytona comedy scene. And it was one of those things where it was just like, oh, I just didn't go looking. And I understand, like, it is a population thing. It's easier to find people in bigger cities because there's more people. But I guarantee you, I know comics that do Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, like Washington, Spokane. Like, Spokane's got a big club. There's a lot of comics that sell that club out. So there's people within a 2-hour drive of that club that love comedy, just like you guys do. Like, they're there. You just got to go out and find them. One person can open up a door to probably 5 or 10 people. That's all it is when I walk into a mic, even in New York, I've been here for 4 years. I still walk into mics where I don't know anybody. If I know one person, and then it's same thing at the tables. Like, when I sit down at the table at the Stand, or if I'm at the Cellar and I run into a comic I know, boom, they're like, oh, this is my friend Brennan. Do you know so-and-so, so-and-so, so-and-so? And it feeds on itself. So yeah, if you just find one person that you can be like, hey, I'm going to take this day off from work, or I finished all my writing early, I'm going to come out with you to Spokane, they'll introduce you to 12 people at the mic. Now you know 13. And then they introduce you to 10 more people. Now you know 30.
How do you perfect the networking side of things when you are doing stand-up? You have a job, you're cutting up the clips.
The work is the work. So like, given, like you say, smaller scale, but is it really a smaller scale? Like, if you're cutting 3 or 4 clips a week, I'm cutting 3 or 4 clips. It's the same work. It's just, you know, the different basis. Like, I have 2 podcasts now. At one point I had 3. And then obviously cutting the clips and all that. It does become a lot, but I say this all the time, and I've got a bunch of bits about using movie lines in real life, but it's because they're true. There's an old movie called Road Trip, and in one of the scenes, the guy goes, it's supposed to be hard. If it was easy, it would just be the way, which is true. He's talking about a shortcut in the movie, but it's true for life. What I do, and even the restaurant I work in, it's one of the best steakhouses in the city. I get to hang out with celebrities at least once a week. I just waited on J.K. Simmons like 2 days ago. Like, it's a cool spot, and it's right in between the Stand and the Cellar. So that's how I've become friends with a lot of comics and like club managers and stuff, and even club owners, is because they come in there to eat and I start talking to them. But it's supposed to be fucking hard. Saying I'm a professional comedian and writing that on your tax form is one of the coolest things in the world. And I know so many people that if they could just do that, they would do that, but they can't. It takes a broken toy. It takes a broken individual to strive for this acceptance from strangers just to make them happy. And I'm blessed and also cursed to be one of those people. And so to me, it's not work. I get off from the restaurant. If I open, I get off around 9. And like I said, I'm equal distances. It's New York, so everything's walking distance to the Stand and the Cellar. So when I get off of work, it's time to go to work. Which club am I going to go to? And I say this all the time. Probably it's a 50-50 shot. 50% of the time I walk in, don't see anybody I know, and I'm like, fuck. And then I go to the train and I go home. And I'm like, cool, I just wasted 30 minutes. Other days I walk in, I see one person I know, they tell me to sit at the table. Now all of a sudden I'm sitting there with Ari Shaffir, Joe List, and like Sam Morril, and I'm like, what the fuck is happening? What is my life? It's not, I don't see it as work because this is what my life is. It's the same thing when I played football. You get up and go to the gym at 6 a.m. because that's the time you go to the gym. It's best not to think about it as like, I don't have to do this. Wednesdays are one of the days off from the restaurant that I have. And everyone's like, oh, that's nice. You get the whole day off. Wednesday is my busiest day by far of any day because I wake up, I go to the gym, I hit three mics, I come home, try to sneak in a quick nap, and then I go to a club for hours just to hang out, talk, maybe get a spot. Wednesday's the day I book shows. And it's like, yeah, I would love a day where I'm just like, fuck this. I'm just going to hang out. And I take those days from time to time. But like, I moved across the country to pursue something that's incredibly difficult. It's like, why would I take days off? That doesn't matter. Every day in New York is a comedy festival. Why would I not want to be a part of that? To me, it's not work. It's just that this is the life.
For Idaho standards, I've chased a dream in Idaho. But like, just like going to New York and just like, saying fuck it, I'm gonna do this, and like people live in their car. You see people on Kill Tony all the time that are like, yeah, I'm living in my car, and they make really bad freaking 1 minute. Their 1 minute is the worst thing I've seen in my life. And Tony's yeah, like, well, you better fucking stay in your car
where you're from. Another... Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and that's the thing too, is like, it's not, again, this it goes back to what I was saying earlier. It's not for the faint of heart. It's not easy, but it, you know, what's the old saying? Anything worth doing is hard, and you know what I mean, or whatever the fucking ism is. It's just, it's difficult, but it's supposed to be. And that's why at the end of the day, I'll be vague about this story, but someone who's very important to a very big club here in New York came into the restaurant one day when I wasn't working. This is someone who has no business knowing who I am, because I'm nobody. And I remember one of the servers was like, oh, one of our servers that works here is a comedian. And she goes, everyone knows who Brennan is. And I was like, dude, that couldn't happen anywhere else in the world. That makes everything worth it.
Yeah, no, that's cool. That's awesome, man. One more, I'll go a football question. How cool was it when you got to a D1, even scout team, that you got to run the ball instead of block every single time?
Dude, when I'll never forget. The first time I went to practice, so getting recruited was hard. My uncle helped me with that. My head coach was trying to get me like these D3 offers. And I was like, no, I want to play D1. So my uncle basically, in his very, you know, he would never say it like this, but basically said, fuck him, we'll do it ourselves. In his very, you know, Christian kind of right-leaning tone, he said it that way, basically. We sent 119 letters out with my highlight tape to 119 schools, because in 2007, there was 119 Division I schools. FAU was the only school that offered me a partial scholarship. There was a lot of other ones that were like, oh, you can walk on, do this, do that. They offered me preferred walk on. I remember I went there, Coach Gerald Robinson, who was the wide receivers coach, was the recruiter in my area. And I remember when I got there, I was like, hell yeah, this is awesome. I met Howard Schnellenberger, who was our head coach at the time, Hall of Fame coach. And I remember he asked me all these weird random questions, like, do you play basketball? And I was like, yeah, I play with my friends. And he goes, do you shoot from outside, or are you just a layup guy? And I go, no, I like to shoot. And he goes, hand-eye coordination, that's what that means. And I was like, all right, let's go. We were one of the only schools, because this is, you know, when Tebow was lighting things up for Florida, everyone was switching to the spread. But Schnellenberger ran a pro-style offense. I was 119 pounds at the time, 6'1", white kid. So I'm not playing offensive line at a D1 school, but you know what a pro style offense needs. A fullback came out to practice and they said skill positions, because I have always been a lineman. When they go skill positions, go to individual. And one of my buddies, he hits me. He goes, come on, let's go. David Muniz, Munsey. He hits me and he goes, come on, let's go. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, we're fullbacks. We're running backs. We go with the running backs. And I was like, what is happening?
Best day of your life, I would imagine, dude.
Dude, I'll never, like, you know, I was there with Alfred Morris, who played in the league for like 10 years. My buddy Willie Rose, who got drafted by the Titans, who was the starting fullback, big 46. But, dude, I remember even just being on scout team, but they're like, I will never forget this till the day I die. My favorite play of all time, 236 Power O, because we ran 36 Power O, crazy. And then 236 Power O was the play action fake. and I was always open in the flat. The fullback was always open in the flat. And I'll never forget, we ran on scout team like my first like 2 or 3 weeks there, and I caught the ball. It barely, because Rusty Smith Jeff Van Camp threw it at me, who was the backup quarterback who was with us on scout team, and he's a 6'5" quarterback at a D1 school. He winged it at me, and I was like, oh shit. And I bobbled it and I caught it and I just ran down the field. And I was like, this is so much better. Like, fuck blocking. Like, my dad was always like, the linemen are the heart of the team. I was like, fuck that. I just scored a tutty, baby. Being a skill position player was awesome it's the same thing with comedy where I'm like, this is the best. And then I rewatched the tape and I'm like, you run like the most unathletic white piece of shit. Like, I'm running down the field and my arms are pumping and I'm like, you have no grace whatsoever, dude.
Well, you know, we did a podcast with Ricardo Chavez, who he was the kicker for Idaho for the last couple years. And we did a little punt pass kick competition. And beforehand, Trey threw me a ball and I ran a little out route and I'm running and my hands are like this close to my side. I'm like, Jesus Christ, you fruit, like pick up your arms a little bit.
Yeah, right. Run like you run before. Yeah. But it is fun because like I still go to the gym 6 days a week because I'm a psycho. And it is fun because I still have some of that strength and skill left in me. So it is cool being 36 years old and being at the gym and being like, oh, I'm the strongest person in here. Like, that's still fun to be like, oh, I still got a little bit of that fullback in me.
I got two quick questions for you. Number one, you said earlier that, you know, Sam Morrell, like, you didn't say how well you knew him or anything, but I was just curious if you knew him well. Do you know what the deal was? Because he used to be on the Games with Names podcast with Julian Edelman when it first started out. So I was just curious if you had any insight on why he stopped going on it.
No, actually, a good question, but I don't, my big rule is I don't put my hands in other people's stuff, like pockets is the term is don't put your hand in other people's pockets. So whenever someone stops doing a show or a podcast or anything, hey, you still doing that thing? Nah, man, I left that. I'm like, all right, cool. And I leave it at that. So I have no idea why he stopped doing it. I did notice though, that he was on it like the first like 10 or 15 episodes. Yeah. Right. And then he was just off it. But again, and normally, especially with bigger comics like that are true comedians like Joe List and Sam Morrell and those guys, whenever I do see them out and they are gracious enough to give me their time, this is going to sound super lame, but we just talk comedy. That's it. It's just, hey, I was trying this bit and this didn't work. Or, hey, I saw you added this tag. It's a lot of that. We're nerds about this stuff.
And I guess the only other question is, you know, it's obviously different with like the internet and stuff. And you know, you say you're in New York, so, you know, maybe there's a little bit more networking and, you know, this person knows this guy. But, you know, like as far as like politics goes in the comedy world, is that something you experienced at all? Like, say, you know, you're getting some shine and then you notice someone's saying, oh, we don't like this guy, and we're going to put, you know, roadblocks in, you know what I mean?
Yeah, so it is a fascinating thing. Politics are everywhere. That's like, I majored in political science because I originally went to college for business and I took a poli sci class as an elective. And I remember being like, oh, my parents got divorced when I was 12. I've been playing politics my whole life. Like, this is what it is. This country doesn't like that country because they said something. I was like, sign me up, dude. This is what I do, man. And I joke about it at work all the time, like at the restaurant. It's like, yeah, nobody wants to polish silverware as a server. But if you polish like one bit of silverware, all of a sudden all the SAs love you and they'll do anything for you. The busters will like sacrifice their firstborn for you because you helped them out. It's like you're always playing politics. There are certain things that do happen, especially in any comedy community. Some of it is, you know, for the better, obviously, like, you know, having more diversity on shows and things like that, which I completely agree with. But there is some stuff where you're kind of like, all right, go fuck yourself. Like, I did a show. There's a reason I don't do a lot of shows in Brooklyn, because when I first moved to New York, I went to a mic in Brooklyn, an open mic in Brooklyn. And I just told a story about one of the times I was arrested. I had a bit about when I got arrested, and I told the story. And in the story, my friend, who's still my friend to this day, his name is Tyrone, we were locked up together. And he said something funny. And so I say that as a bit. And a white woman, of course, came up to me after and was like, you can't tell that story. And I was like, what are you talking about? And she's like, you're perpetuating stereotypes for that story. You can't tell that story. And I was like, but that's what happened. That's my friend. So in that instance, there are times where people will be like, oh, well, we just can't have you because you're not like good for the community. But then I was just like, well, fuck this. And I just didn't go back to Brooklyn. Like, I was like, if that's what this is going to be, then I just won't go.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then one more question real quick, just because hearing you say that made me think about something else. But and this kind of reminds me of Daniel Tosh. You know, I've heard for a long time that when Daniel Tosh first started to become famous, that he was getting a lot of heat, I guess. He got so blown up so quickly, whereas you have these other comedians that have been grinding for a long time, and then Daniel Tosh just kind of seemed to go from here all the way up there. So do you think that there are some comics that look at someone and like be, oh, this guy is higher where I'm at right now, so F him. So.
Oh, yeah, jealousy runs thick, and jadedness is crazy. I'll tell you a quick story just based on that premise. I went to, there's the Grizzly Pear here in New York, which is a famous kind of dive comedy club. I love it, but it is one of those things where it's like, people, Grizzly Pear gets most of its audience from people who can't go to a Cellar show because it's sold out, because it's like three doors down. And I'll never forget, we were sitting there for an open mic. The mic started at 4:30. I got there around 4, and I'm just hanging out with all the other comics, and we're just shooting the shit. And this guy at the bar turns, and he's like, what are you guys here for? Drinking a beer at like 4 o'clock in the afternoon. No harm in that. I used to start drinking at 9 a.m. So I was like, oh, we're here for the mic. And he was like, ugh, comedy? And we were like, yeah. And then he went, turned and kept drinking his beer. And I was like, the fuck's that guy's problem? And one of the older like mic comics was like, oh, that's so-and-so. He did comedy for like 5 years. Some of his friends blew up and he just never made it. So he quit. Yeah. And I was like, but he still comes to the Grizzly Pear to shit on newer, like to New York comedians. And they're like, yeah, he does it like once a month. He'll get hammered and come down here and just shit on everybody because they're still doing it. Like that kind of jaded. And I have it. I have friends that are much more famous than I am. And I sometimes get frustrated because I'll see their sets and I'll be like, I would blow, and I should say more acquaintances than friends, because normally with my friends, I'm very happy for them. But I have people that I met at open mics that are hot and all of a sudden blew up on Instagram because of something. And I'm like, I would bury that person. Like, what the fuck is wrong with the internet? Why are you so stupid? But it's just the way the algorithm is, and they, you know, they caught it. And so, yeah, that the jealousy and stuff does run deep, but I try to live by the old football mentality. If I eat, you eat, we all eat. So it's just kind of one of those things where a rising tide lifts all ships. And it has benefited me because I do have friends who have gotten more and more, you know, traction, and they're still my friends. So they'll still come on my podcast. They still promote my stuff. They still, you know, accept my collab invites. So it's like one of those things where it's like, yeah, there's room for everybody, but I'd be lying if I say, when I see some people get certain things, I don't get heated because I'm like, fuck them. But what the fuck?
Yeah. You know, I never understood like that guy you're talking about who just sat at the bar, did comedy for 5 years and was like, oh, comedy. I never understood that mindset. And I also never understood like the story you said before about people that get mad at jokes for going at, while they're going to a comedy show. Like, why would you purposefully get mad?
Well, because people live in this world and they think everyone else lives in that world. And I tend to shake those barriers a lot just because, you know, again, I'm a white kid who's been arrested 8 times. I was a Division I athlete. Most of my friends, like some of my closest friends, are black guys. And so it is weird when I tell a joke about one of those friends and then people are like, you're being that guy. And it's like, well, you're only saying that because you have zero black friends, but the internet tells you you're not supposed to talk about this. It's like, I have a friend at work, dude. And I say out of pocket shit to him. And he's like, he laughs and goes, Brennan, you're lucky you're black, or man, we'd have a problem. And it's like, cause that's the world. But seriously, like that's the world. But a lot of these people like are so indoctrinated to this like stuff you see online and everything. And I'm not here being like cancel culture or woke bull. Like I'm not doing any of that. I think a lot of it is good. I don't, you know, I think a lot of that stuff, like making people more comfortable, you know, gay comics or, you know, LGBTQIA+ comic, like women, especially. Dude, I know so many female comedians that are my good friends now who would not come on the podcast when they first met me because they go, you're a fucking huge dude from Florida. I thought you were going to try and rape me or something. Like, and I don't take that personally. Like that's out there. That exists. So like, I think all that stuff is good. What the reason I start to push back is it's like my good friend Matt Folcheron always says this, me holding this microphone is the universal sign for I'm just fucking around. So like, why are you getting so bent out of shape about this? Like, so I agree with you in the sense where it's like, but there are a lot of people who want to die on these hills because they think they're changing the world.
Yeah, no, I like that, that saying. And I also, it's just like, you're at a comedy show. You should just know that walking in, but I know it's not that.
But people don't. Yeah. People don't. They think because their algorithm is curated to them, so they only see the stand-up they like, that if they walk into the stand or the cellar, it's going to be their algorithm. And then they see Godfrey up there talking about how white people stole everything, which is true, and they're like, how dare he? And it's like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, all those people pissed off just have Matt Rife on their algorithm and nobody else.
You said it. I didn't say it.
I love Matt Rife, dude. I do.
The person is, he's a very sweet guy.
Yeah, it's like him. It like, well, I feel like stand up that just appeals, and then like, this is probably going to be a ignorant thing to say, but just like the ones who have algorithms of stand up that's like just appeals to women, I would say, like Jeff Akuri, who is very funny, and Matt Rife, I feel like are the ones that get offended at comedy shows.
It's ironic that you say that, because I know Jeff, he's so funny, and he's in my funny algorithm. He's in, because I'm very effeminate like he is. Like, it's funny, I did a bunch of stuff with Hannah Berner when she first started doing the Hannah on the Street stuff, before she started doing it with super famous people and it blew up. She used to do it with comics, and I was one of the comics that would do it. And I always caught myself talking like this, because I was raised by my sisters. Like, I was raised around women. So like, when I talk to Hannah, I feel like I'm with my sisters again. So I'll do like this. And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, dude? You look like so gay. I can relate to like Jeff, because he has a fiance. She's awesome too. And it's one of those things though, where it's like, oh yeah, sometimes I am like, oh my God, shut up. And I'm like, wait, why did I just say it like that?
Two more quick comedy related questions, and then Trey is gonna try to make you laugh with some of writing, some of his jokes, some of his material. I want to know what your writing process is like, because you are a storytelling comedian. So I am curious how that writing goes, if you are somebody that writes these stories down, try to memorize how that works. And then give me a story of when you bombed and what you think your best show was.
Okay, so I've got trigger answers for all these, locked and loaded. I live my life. That's my writing process. You can't tell stories about stuff you've never done. So whenever I go to a new city on tour or anything, I go out, I do stuff, go to museums, go to the parks, walk around. And then also this is one thing that's helped me in podcasting as a host, but I'm so fascinated by other people's stories, like how they get to where they are. That it helps me as a storytelling comic, because a lot of times I'll talk to people about certain things, and then that will trigger memories in my own head where I'm like, oh. So what I'll do is, whenever I have something happen and I'm telling a story to friends or to family or whatever, and if a bunch of people are like, oh, that's so funny, or they're laughing, I'll just make a note of it in my phone. Or I've got probably like 20 or 30 of these little joke books, like just little notebooks just all around the house. I carry 4 or 5 of them in my backpack. And literally, I just write down like 4 or 5 things. And then, so like, my jokes turn into just, you know, 1 or 2 lines where it's like, you know, movie lines, or look like a cop, or DUI stories or something like that. And then I'll just tell those on stage. And again, that helps me with the story I'd say is never going to be verbatim the same thing, because I have the story, I just don't know how I'm going to tell it that particular night. And then for the second part of the question, the worst bomb I've ever had was, I was featuring for my buddy Matt Folcheron in Philadelphia at a club that doesn't exist anymore. It was called the Jester Castle. They booked the first night, Friday, they booked the African American Professional Women's Association of Philadelphia, sold like 150 tickets. And the booker was the manager of the club, who was a schmuck, was so excited, called Matt and he goes, hey, we're sold out. We're like over capacity. And Matt asked why, and he goes, oh, it's the Professional Women African American Women's Association of Philadelphia. And Matt goes, hey, that's a corporate event. One, if they paid for tickets for the whole club, then you should let them pick the comedians. Two, I don't think I'm the right comic for that. because, you know, we're both straight white dudes that live in major cities. We're like, maybe not for us. And then the booker emailed Matt back and was like, listen, we told them that they probably, this might not be the show for them. Cause you know, older white women love Jesus and God. And Matt has a bunch of material that's about growing up Catholic, which isn't favorable to the church. So he was like, why don't you book somebody else? And so the booker said, yeah, we figured it out. We showed up to Philadelphia and there's a restaurant at the like ground level. And it was just all these beautifully dressed middle-aged black women. And I look at Matt and Matt looks at me and he goes, you think? And I went, nah. And we went up and he lied to us. He said that he told them to come on a different night and they didn't. Five straight white guys was the entertainment for the African American Professional Women's Association of Philadelphia. And I was supposed to do 20. And right before I went up, the guy who was like the owner and booker of the club was like, hey, just do 5. And I looked at him and I went, yeah, no shit. And the reason why it was so bad was because it was ambush comedy. So they're playing music and stuff before, they're delivering food. So all these women just think they're having a nice night out at like this fun place. And then the host goes to get on stage and one of the women stops him. She goes, hey, what are you doing? And he goes, oh, I'm going to go start the comedy show. And she went, comedy show? And I was like, oh, this is going to be bad.
Oh, man.
So I did probably 12 minutes of material in 5 minutes because I was so panicked. I was talking so fast. And I got one big applause break when I talked. I have a bit where when I set it up, I go, I was raised by women, strong, powerful, independent women. And literally, it's just to pander to the audience. And so they all cheered. And then I go, and the next line of the bit is, who are also wildly into astrology. And then immediately went from cheering to boo. And I was like, oh, this is going to be terrible. And then I just talked to myself for 4 minutes because that was the only reaction I got. And then it was just silence, which was deafening. So that's definitely the worst show I ever did. Yeah, you think you're prepared for everything until you have to do something like that. And you're like, oh, I'm not prepared for this. It's the same thing that when I got to FAU and I was like, I was all county, I'll be fine. And then you walk in and you're like, oh, these are grown ass men. Like, I'm not prepared for this at all.
One more quick thing about the writing I want to harken back to. When you're telling a story and stuff, like you have this one bit that I saw on your Instagram reels where you talk about putting your head through a guy's window. Yeah. And at the end you say, you know, no one flirts with my sister except me or something along the lines of that. I don't want to ruin your bit. You do it.
No, that's the bit. Nobody flirts with my sister but me, buddy.
Can you come up with those tags, you know?
So a lot of the best tags that I have are on the spot tags. So I was telling that story and I thought it was so funny because the natural tag that I wrote was the, real quick for the whole audience, don't knock yourself unconscious before you get into a fight. That's stupid. That was the tag that I wrote. But the story in itself is naturally incredibly dark. And I talk about putting my head through a guy's car window. But I knew the story was funny because when I would tell it on podcasts and stuff, it would get a reaction. So I was like, there's something here. And I did it at a show probably 6 months ago. And just out of nowhere, I just threw in, yeah, because nobody flirts with my sister but me, buddy. And the room erupted. And I was like, oh, that's because it breaks the tension. I'm like, isn't this so, like, how dumb is this to say this? And it sounds weird, but there's an inherent value talking about, like, isn't, like, this guy's from Florida and he's talking about flirting with his sister. Obviously, it's not germane to the tag, but like incest porn is a thing. So everybody is like, it immediately clicks something in people's heads where they're like, oh, that's sick. So like, and there's so many of those nuanced, subtle things that people don't realize they're thinking about when like you say a tag or you hit a line. That's why like Jeselnik is so good because he'll like hit something where you're like, I never even realized I was thinking about that. When he says something. So like that I literally threw that line out there as like a throwaway, like, oh my God, this audience is way too quiet. And the room went crazy. And then when I went into real quick for the whole room, don't knock yourself unconscious. It still gets a laugh, but that whole thing, cause I remember someone in comedy told me once not even in comedy, a manager once told me, he goes, yeah, but it's a crazy story, but where's the punchline? And I was like, when everybody laughs, when I say the flirting with my sister line, he goes, oh yeah, that is pretty funny. And I was like, oh, so this joke is almost bulletproof, where if like a suit is telling me it's funny, because they don't know comedy for shit. I was like, oh, this might actually be bulletproof by adding that stupid, silly line. And I have so many bits like that, where it was just like, you throw something out there, because anybody who tries comedy on any level is a funny person to a degree. So if you're in a panic mode, you just throw a lifeline out there and it hits, you're like, oh, that's the new tag. You'd be shocked what your brain is like, say this, and you're like, bleh. And then you're like, oh, that's it, that's the bit.
No, yeah, I know, because when you said it in that clip I saw, I was like, that didn't seem natural, but he came up with it and it killed, and I was like, this is good.
Yeah, and it's a huge misdirect too, because it's like, I'm standing up for my sister. Oh, what a good big brother. Oh, wait, he's talking about flirting with his sister? That's gross.
I do appreciate the storytelling aspect of comedy and like how people do that. But I also like, just good written comedy, because I am a journalist and I'm a writer at heart. So like people that can like set that up and write really well, I'm a real sucker for that.
Yeah, I am too, actually. It's funny because I tend to gravitate more towards comedy that isn't my style. So when I see people who can do set up punch, like legit, like writers, I'm like, damn, man, that's so good. Like, how did you even come up with that? That's great.
I know Mark Norman's insane. I love watching him, because he can do that kind of set up punch like no other. And that's why Tuesdays with Stories is one of my favorites, because the way Joe and Mark just go off each other.
Yeah, because
like,
Joe does that too. Joe's more of a storyteller on stage, but you get him on a podcast, he'll just start throwing zingers out. Dave Attell is like the originator of that, where he's so anti-story. He's done setups before, hit the punchline, and then in the back of my head, I'm like, but wait, what happened to the guy in the story? Like, wait, because he'll just move on to the next bit. He'll be like, yeah, I saw a guy smoking on the street, and then like, boom, hit the punchline and then move on. And I'm like, wait, what about the guy smoking on the street? We're just done with that now?
Here comes Trey with the new Treyism. So without further ado, Trey, the floor is yours.
All right. So the other day I figured out that I got arrested for something. But Treep, I did find out that the Statue of Aspirations ran out.
Statue of Aspirations.
You know, sometimes in life you have to take the path with the least amount of fences. But
that got me.
But you know, sometimes when you're going out and doing these podcasts, you gotta go out there, you gotta set the cones.
The problem I'm running into is I'm trying to guess what you're gonna do before you're doing it, and it's tripping me up. I'm like, I'm a professional, I can guess what's coming, and I haven't been able to yet.
Yeah.
You gotta set the cones. What do you got next?
All right. So you know what this whole podcast thing, Tree, you know, we keep running into, we actually had a little bit of, you know, a scuffle before, you know, with some comedy people, but I feel like they're just trying.
Oh. Do it again. Restart.
Okay. So, Treeb, with this whole podcast thing, getting into a little bit of a feud with this one guy, they just keep trying to want to keep driving the fridge between us instead of a wedge.
Yeah.
Fridge, yeah.
No, we got it. We got it. We're there with you.
Yeah. We understand.
But with that not so good joke, I just want to take this moment. I want to make a sense for the latest joke, because it wasn't that good.
That one wasn't that great either. That's okay though.
Oh, you started so hot. Come on, we got some more in there.
All right. Well, we're gonna bring this one home. This is one of the questionable ones that I don't know if it's gonna make the podcast or not. So,
all right, what do we got?
So, doing this podcast, see, there's different ways to do this comedy thing, right? You know, you get in there, you do a podcast, or you do the stand-up route, you do local, you try to network with people. What I'm trying to say in all of this is that there are many different ways to skin the blacks.
I didn't think that was gonna be the one.
I knew it was gonna be something bad. I knew. I was like, he's gonna say Jews or something.
I don't know if I'll keep that in, but I did like it.
I did elicit a response from me, which is something that we're shooting for.
Yeah, that's kind of all I got written down for this week, but I'm just going to go with my favorite one since the guy is here. Well, one of my favorite ones.
Yeah.
Just remember, anything in life, doing this podcast thing, do not hit all your eggs with just one tennis racket.
That's his best one. He's done that with all of our guests.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah.
I like the fences one the best. That's my favorite.
The fences.
Appreciate it. Yeah.
I think the problem with Trey and these Treyisms, you know, some of them are good and he hits them, but the thing is like all of his setups are the same. He always says, you know what, this podcasting thing,
yeah.
Yeah.
you gotta, because I've never actually looked at your notes with these. Yeah, you just write the Treyisms. You gotta write the setup with
it. Yeah. Well, plus, I think if I get it, like how Ricky is and he's like acting all mad, if I just got into character a little bit more, I think it would be more funny. Like,
yeah, you gotta commit to the bit, yeah. Man. That's the one thing I've noticed, especially like it doesn't matter what kind of bit you're doing, even if you know it's bad or even if you know it's like you're probably not supposed to say this, you got to commit to it. That's the whole thing.
Yeah, that's true. The skin the blacks one, if you didn't give any preface to that and you just said it, it would have been even more funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Because so the lead up kind of.
Yeah, because they would have been shock and awe. We wouldn't have.
I would have expected. I don't know what I would have done.
Thank you for putting up with our amateur comedy here. We do appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Come on. This is every open mic I've ever... You could probably take that to an open mic and fucking crush. If you guys ever need me back on to ramble about football, maybe when the Jags start playing awesome this season and Travis Hunter and Brian Thomas go for like 10 combined touchdowns in the first three games, I'll come back on. We'll talk Jags.
Hell yeah. I know that was probably one of the best parts of this podcast was finding out you were a Jags fan.
Jags fan. Tony Khan, it's him. Tony Khan was a regular of mine. And it was funny, one last thing before we go, the best part about having the owner's son of the Jacksonville Jaguars as your regular at a restaurant is he's a really cool, down-to-earth guy, and I almost thought we were buddies. And then he'd be doing billion-dollar deals, and I'd be like, Tony, did you see the fucking Indiana game last night? And he was like, thank you. That's enough now. And I'd be like, oh, yeah. You're working right now, and I'm being an asshole.
Tell all 40 of our listeners and our parents where they can find you on Instagram and things.
At Brennan T. Comedy on all social media. The website is BrennanTComedy.com. I'm on tour right now. I'm in Florida next week. I'm in Dallas. I'm in Denver in September. So just check out the website, BrennanTComedy.com, and listen to my podcast, Your Ex-Drinking Buddy. I have a pretty big name guests on every week to talk about their best and worst drinking, drug, party, and getting in trouble stories. The X is because I've been sober for 7 years, so it's Your Ex Drinking Buddy.
Yeah, we didn't get to get into too much drinking stuff, but I feel like the comedy stuff was pretty good. So that'll settle it.
Pretty good. I'll take that. That's literally the reviews of most of my sets. That's pretty good.
And then that's what we get a... We get reviews from our parents saying, stop talking about shit and pubes so much.
Oh, yeah. But then... you would have gotten maybe three sentences into that, and I'd be like, all right, guys, let's talk about something else. It's so weird, too, because when I'm with my girlfriend, just a little aside, I'm like the dumbest. Like, I put my jockstrap from working out on my face, and I talk like Bane. Like, I'm gross. I fart. I do all that stuff. But it's so weird when it comes to like comedy or podcasting, when people want to talk about like shit and farts and sex, I'm like, all right, we can move off of this. I don't know why. There's like a little voice in my head that's like, okay, save this for like when nobody's listening.
Yeah. You know, and I swear I don't, when me and Trey get on a mic, I swear my first instinct isn't to ask him how he wipes his ass, but somehow.
I saw that clip. Yeah. And I was like, what did I get myself into?
Yeah. Well, hey, we kept it pretty PG for you.
No, I appreciate it, yeah.
Thanks, man, for coming on, and thank you guys for listening. And I hope you guys have a great rest of your day.